just finished off the show with Tolerance, a band from Japan. A release called Divin' came out in 1981 and just got reissued. The song is called Pulse Static. And maybe it bled into another song. Honestly, I don't know. It's very mysterious, this packaging. I think it's... I think I was playing it at a slower speed than intended. But again, it's mysterious. There's no labeling anywhere. I guess I could listen to it online, but that doesn't seem like much fun. I'm going to say it's meant to be at 45, even though it's like a 12-inch LP. And I'm going to leave it unmarked, unlabeled, and leave other FMU DJs to figure it out for themselves, see what speed they think this record should be. Maybe it changes side by side. Who knows? It's been awesome hanging out with everybody today, and I hope you have a good week. It's WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City, and Rockland County 91.9 FM, and online WFMU.org. Today, Mark Hurst is not in, but station manager Ken will be filling in, and he has an interview planned. So make sure you catch his show. Bye!
Welcome to Tectonic, everybody. Station manager Ken here, filling in for your regular host, Mark Hurst, who shall return next week. Tectonic features conversations with creators and thinkers who are charting the way forward in an ever-weirdening, tech-saturated society. And tonight we have, I think, a really interesting interview with the author David Auerbach, who wrote the recent book MegaNets, How Digital Forces Beyond Our Control Commandeer Our Daily Lives and Inner Realities. And this interview will take around 38 minutes, and then I'm hoping that in the last 20 minutes of the hour tonight, we can open up the phone lines at 201-209-9368 and discuss some of the ideas that David discusses. One of the things that interests me a great deal about David Auerbach's book is that he has a unique perspective for a tech critic in that he is a coder, that he spent 10 years working at both Microsoft and Google as a software engineer, which I think gives him a very different viewpoint of a lot of the issues that we talk about here, or that Mark talks about here on Tectonic. And David Auerbach is one of the few people who took the advice, not that he took it from Mark, but it does so happen that he decided to resign from the tech industry because he started to see that as the products that he was building for Google and for Microsoft got larger and larger, the creators and the companies were completely losing control of them. And this gets to his concept of the MegaNet. He defines the MegaNet as an extremely large human-machine collaboration, not just companies like Twitter or Facebook, but also governmental, national identity regimes, certain blockchain regimes, et cetera, et cetera. He argues that the people who created these MegaNets cannot control them, that regulators cannot regulate them. And we'll talk about why they cannot be regulated in the way that other entities have been regulated. He suggests a couple of different ways to tame MegaNets, such as decentralization of the type that you see at the Twitter clone Blue Sky, as well as Mastodon, as well as WFMU's chat boards are very decentralized in terms of their moderation controls. Another suggestion that he has for taming the power and damage of the MegaNets is to taint the data banks, something that we hope you'll all do. We do hope that you'll spend some time today tainting the data banks, meaning offering bad data about yourself to the MegaNets. David gets into the trend of, speaking of decentralization, the trend of narrative bunkers, also known as bubble filters. We discuss whether the internet is now polluting itself thanks to the spate of nonsensical text now populating the internet thanks to large language models like ChatGPT. We do get into ChatGPT and AI and the idea of confusing language with intelligence or consciousness or understanding. We get into the absurd notion that all these ChatGPT language models are hallucinating. David also talks about national digital ID cards, including India's Aadhaar system, the Chinese social credit system that we've all heard so much about, as well as what tiny little Estonia is doing in terms of national digital ID cards. We get into an old tale of clever Hans, the horse that supposedly could do mathematical problems, which leads us into the anthropomorphization of ChatGPT, as well as horses who can clop their foot to various mathematical questions. So we're going to listen to this in two parts. Once again, we're going to be talking to David Auerbach, who has a brand new book called MegaNets. And then at the end, I'm hoping that you will call up and discuss some of the points that we get into. Here then is tonight's interview. David Auerbach, welcome to Tectonic.
Hi, thanks for having me.
David is the author of the recent book, Meganets, How Digital Forces Beyond Our Control Commandeer Our Daily Lives and Inner Realities, heretofore known as Meganets. And you previously wrote a book, Bitwise, A Life in Code, which I guess was based on your years as a software engineer at Microsoft and Google.
Yeah. I think in some ways both books came about from seeing how what I did in those years and sort of the first decade of the century played out in subsequent years and how much it surprised me. The first book, Bitwise, being a bit more from a personal perspective, and the my current book, Meganets, being more from a social perspective.
Yeah, and what you write about, what you mentioned about your years at Microsoft and Google, is what you saw was a loss of control as the product grew bigger and bigger.
Yeah, and not only that, but one something that really snuck up on us, I think, something that the key element and the reason why I decided that it was worth trying to coin a new word, which is always a crapshoot, is that I felt like people were really all of us programmers and engineers really had not anticipated the degree to which our users would be exerting influence on the algorithms to the extent that engineers and even companies and regulatory agencies would not be able to control their own, control these mega nets, by which I mean things like not just social networks, but also cryptocurrency networks, online games, any sort of network that brings together millions upon millions of users that are constantly shaping the algorithms and, influencing them. So that, we tend to think of software as, historically anyway, we thought of it as you code something up and you ship it into a box, and if there are bugs, you fix it. But for the most part, people are passive recipients of that code. And that's not at all what you see today, because all of your very actions are influencing the weightings and what you see, and they're constantly changing. So you're never stepping into the same data stream twice. And those changes aren't being done by the engineers, they're being done by all the users collectively, although none of them so much that they are exerting decisive control. So what happens is the control is sort of floated up into the atmosphere, sort of like the economy. And I don't think we've yet quite accepted that we have a lot less control over these meganets than I think it's assumed that we do.
The size of these meganets means that human intention, the creator's intention or the company's intention, as well as algorithmic logic, have no part to play whatsoever.
It's a component. But it's much more coarse-grained than it used to be. So there are things you can say that, certainly, Twitter could just pull the plug on their servers tomorrow and Twitter would go away. That's true. But if you think, okay, can Facebook actually stamp out every instance of racism on their platform? That's no longer possible. That's a consequence of the size.
Yeah, you talked about Facebook during the pandemic and how they came under criticism to rid the platform of anti-vax information and conspiracy theories related to the to COVID. And they promised they would. And in the end, you seem to say that they really wanted to and they really tried and they just couldn't.
Yeah, I think that's true, not just of Facebook, but also of Twitter, that they certainly stamped out some things. They put warning labels on some things, but they certainly didn't catch all of it. And B, if you look at just how attitudes have changed, they didn't really. But after the initial sort of setting of opinions, people pretty much didn't move. There remained, I think, 30% of the U.S. at least that was just going to believe what one might categorize as unorthodox views on the matter, one thing or another, up to and including that like plandemic video. And I don't know if folks remember the Plandemic video. That was the one that was sort of saying that the whole thing was a conspiracy. And I think that Facebook did stamp out that single video, but you can see how little that did. You know, the ideas got into circulation, the content can be converted into all sorts of things. So when you're trying to filter on particular types of intention and particular types of meaning, so Facebook could eliminate a particular video, but those ideas were in circulation. And yeah, you know, computers are not good at filtering on ideas. They can filter on specified content. So if you wanted to filter out anything that says plandemic, that you can do. But as you know, China runs into this all the time. People use euphemisms, then you can get on it. Not to mention that a lot of people tend to get aggrieved if they feel like unorthodox but not illegal content is being stripped out, and you know, that being a foundation of a free liberal society, that you can believe crazy things. And I think MegaNets have just brought these tensions to the fore in a way that the country has literally never seen before.
You did write that people are searching for where the power really lies when it does not lie anywhere.
And, that's right.
And this gets into the fact that, and we talk about it a lot on this show, that a lot of people do acknowledge the problems with these giant social networks and other types of meganets. But there doesn't seem to be any fixing it, much less even slowing it down.
Yeah, and it's weird because, you know, this isn't a get out of jail free card for these networks, for these companies. I think they owe it to us to at least be more honest about what they're doing, and I think at least be more transparent as well, so we can see this loss of control for ourselves. We're encountering this now with AI as well, where AIs behave in weird ways, but we can, you know, it's up to these private companies to dig in and say, oh, this is why it did this or that. And what I mean when I say that the power doesn't lie anywhere, it's that it's devolved, that has devolved so that each of us has gotten a little bit of power over these networks, none of it decisive. And that power has come at the expense of any sort of centralized elite entities who still maintain more power. But if you get the impression, there's this impression that they can't control their own system. And that's something that I think the narrative that Facebook really did not want to catch on was that they could not control their own systems. When, for example, I think they were having like neo-Nazi propaganda on Swedish Facebook, I believe. I think I mentioned this in the book. And there was this general sense of, okay, well, why is this even there? How hard can it be? It's certainly, as far as I can tell, there's not a great financial incentive for something like that. Like, if Facebook could get rid of it, I really do think they would. I don't think it's a lack of will. I think it is literally a lack of ability.
Right. You're saying that the problem with Facebook is not greed, nor is it pure ambition to destroy liberal democracy as we know it. It's just that it's a monster that they've created that they really can't rein in.
Right. And now, you know, they did say you break it, you bought it. So, you know, as long as they're in charge of it, they do bear some responsibility. But asking them to do the impossible is not a helpful approach, because even if they wanted to, they couldn't.
So right. And that's why you've also come out against governmental regulatory approach to try to solve these problems.
Some of them. I mean, I think regulation is great in some ways. I'm very happy that the EU is going to force Apple to use USB instead of lightning cables. That's great. Regulation like that is great. It's when you get into a regulatory approach that assumes that effectively is going to try to regulate what can't be regulated, that it's just going to turn into a blame game and everybody's going to be just pointing the fingers at anyone else. It can become kind of an excuse. When Facebook created their, you know, their council of I think, do you remember what it was called? The Facebook Content Council or something like that?
I do remember it. I can't recall what it was called.
I mean, that was clearly they're looking for a nice, convenient scapegoat so that they can say, well, we didn't make that decision. That was our council. And in the case where regulatory apparatus can't actually do much good, I think that that's the tech companies will be more than happy to say, like, well, we're regulated, so we're doing what they're saying. So it's not an argument against regulation per se, but a lot of the regulatory approaches being suggested, I think, are non-starters because they literally are advocating the impossible and will end up with things like, you know, all the cookie acceptance dialogues, which are supposedly, you know, a privacy mechanism, but I don't really see that as having accomplished much. I don't know how you feel.
I like the fact that your book comes up with ways, at least, that the problem can be tamed, the problem of meganets. And I think you had 6 points. I don't think we'll have time to discuss them all, but some of them really fascinated me. One, of course, you're talking about decentralization of the types that Mastodon and Blue Sky, as well as WFMU's own chat network utilizes. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I think that, you know what, Twitter has been such a flashpoint because it is an anomaly. It served as a public square where you could see lots and lots of things you didn't like on nonstop, and it was all and it was joining everybody together. I think that in fact that is on the way up because it's not even particularly profitable, and you will see an increasing number of what I term narrative bunkers of people, you know, joining up with more like-minded souls and shutting out the content that is either offensive to them or just alien to them. Mm-hmm. And that's not great in itself, but I do think that that's what we're going towards, is a lack of centralization in that regard as well. And it's good to the point that, you know, that you don't want a company like, you know, you don't want a company like Twitter, whether Elon Musk is running it or not, because if you look at one of the nice things about Musk leaking that stuff for those internal documents about Twitter is that you saw that they were a mess even before he took over. It's just that I think he was under the impression that it would make him look good in comparison, and then there he was mistaken. But that's the thing, is that
decentralization of the type that Mastodon and Blue Sky have implemented, is that even possible for a really large meganet such as Facebook?
I guess it's a good it is. It is. I mean, the issue is what remains. You know, you can see it as an extension of what we have with Discord today, where all this online discourse becomes a bit more effectively private. And there's nothing, you know, only inertia is going to stop you from getting there. But in a way, it kind of proves my point in that you aren't doing anything to get rid of the problematic content other than for trying your best to silo it so that whatever is problematic to one group tends not to appear to it.
Right.
And decentralization is an approach to that. I think, on the other hand, you will still have centripetal forces that will try to monopolize these. I mean, you know, Mastodon is not new. And the difficulties that you have with that is that, you know, networks of certain sizes, they tend to grow. They tend to that unless you have a really robust mechanism of sort of sharing data, at which point the decentralization sort of coalesces into one giant network anyway, in which point you're just making sort of a meta Twitter, except now everybody's fighting amongst themselves. So on the one hand, you have the centrifugal force where people are just bunkering themselves up and ignoring everybody else. On the other hand, you have the centripetal force of, okay, well, a large network is going to attract more users than a smaller network. And those things are going to continue to be in tension. And in both directions, neither of them really solve the underlying problem, which is that you still don't have a way to control, say, some explosive piece of information or misinformation that you really want to tamp down before it gets completely out of control.
Okay, another one of your ideas for how to tame the meganet problem was tainting or polluting the MegaNet data banks. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that one's a controversial one. That was definitely one of my more aggressive suggestions. And this gets to, I mean, we already know that, you know, Facebook has profiles on people who literally have never signed up, that there are these shadow online profiles for us all over the world, both governmental and non-governmental, and they tend to coalesce as well. So we are being filtered, judged, assessed, marketed to based on data that we don't even see, much less have any guarantees of being accurate. And this has been discussed in policy circles where they want to give people more control over their data. But at this point, it's a loaded analogy, but it is a bit like, well, the data's already out there, just like there are already like so many guns out there that even if you were to literally ban the selling of guns tomorrow, you would not reduce sort of the amount of firearms in the United States. Well, same with the data. It's already out there. What you can do, however, is you can put more data out there to muddy the waters. And, you know, this is something that's been suggested on an individual level, which is give companies false information about yourself. You know, I actually use a different birthday than my actual birthday in the hope of foiling people matching up my profiles. Mm-hmm. But individual efforts aren't going to be enough. There's too much out there to put the onus on an individual person. But if you were to go out and intentionally just start poisoning data sources and spreading competing false information, you would effectively lower the faith that people have and the credulity people can take in the data that they get for free that's out there. And ultimately, they would have to go and hopefully and ask the users themselves to share information about themselves. So rather than trying to remove personal data that's already out there, you're basically trying to delegitimize it by making it unclear what's right and what's not.
Isn't the internet kind of self-polluting already? I mean, the internet seems like it just, the quality of things gets worse and worse. And now with large language models becoming a part of the content of the internet, it just seems like, it's polluting itself.
It's a really good question. I mean, and I think that this is something that I would love to see, you know, like some serious academic research on, because there are obviously great tendencies towards the multiplication of inaccuracies, falsehoods, whatever. At the same time, there are self-regulating apparatuses on it, by which correct data is obtained and incorrect data is filtered out. You know, people are providing more correct data about themselves. And often you can say, well, I know enough about this piece of data to privilege it over, say, something I got from some third party data broker. So what you're saying is definitely true, but there are forces in the other direction. And in fact, you know, what we're looking at, especially with regard to AI, is that, yeah, humans are going to act as editors for AI. AI is going to provide the raw stuff because it can do that really quickly. And then humans are going to be tasked with making sure it's accurate and good enough. So you correct for that by effectively trying to create a positive human-machine interaction, which I guess is already there. You know, my book about MegaNets focuses on the negative effects of this human-machine collaboration. But you know, there's no question we get benefit from this. And some of that is actually in, yeah, some self-correcting mechanisms that have evolved. So yes and no, I suppose. And a lot of it is, I think, something, yeah, you find out empirically.
We are halfway through my interview with David Auerbach, author of the recent book MegaNets, How Digital Forces Beyond Our Control Commandeer Our Daily Lives and Inner Realities. David talks about MegaNets being extremely large, quickly growing, networks that are not comprised only of algorithms and code, but also of the many millions of people who are influencing it and feeding information into it. There's another 18 minutes of the interview to go, and then I'm hoping that we can have a short conversation on the air about it. The phone number is 201-209-9368. Here's the second half of the interview with David Auerbach. I think you wrote in the book that if big tech has our data, then why are targeted ads so terrible?
Yeah. I love to quote the fact that Facebook thought I was black for like 5 years or so. I have no idea why. I can tell you I've never claimed to be black, but somehow it figured it out. And that's the thing, is that there's outside of realms in which it's considered mission critical to be accurate, such as, say, the medical realm or arguably speaking, certain governmental realms where at least there's a higher bar before the government agencies simply can't take data willy-nilly and put them into their databases, and even if there are some problems with accuracy nonetheless, there's so little ways even for these companies to measure the accuracy of their own data. There's no question that Facebook would love for that data to be accurate. And yet, if you look at it, whenever people get access to it, they see that no, it's littered with errors. They get to the point of it's good enough, or maybe not even good enough, and they work with what they've got.
It's rife with
very imprecise.
It seems like it's rife with pure fabrication, and you talk about large language models as being subject to a problem where language is being confused with understanding. And
yeah,
the fact that large language models like ChatGPT, et cetera, don't have any idea what's true and what's not true. And it's not even it seems like it's not even relevant to them.
Well, there's that level of semantics just isn't there. Certainly not explicitly. And it doesn't seem to be implicitly. I don't know if you saw the story that happened like last week about the lawyer who got in huge trouble after submitting a brief that ChatGPT had written.
Yes, exactly. I was thinking about that. For the listeners who may have missed that, can you give us a synopsis of what happened there?
Yeah, there was some case, and I don't even know the detail. It was a typical legal case, but the lawyer had used ChatGPT to generate a brief, and it cited a couple cases just in footnotes. And the lawyer evidently hadn't bothered to check. And the judge said, you know, these cases don't seem to exist. Please submit the summaries. And so he did submit the summaries, which were ChatGPT written, and they were made up cases. Not only that, one of them, the summaries weren't even coherent. One of them started off as a destruction of property case and morphed into a copyright case, something like that. But they weren't coherent. So clearly the lawyer wasn't exactly doing any due diligence here. But the lawyer probably thought, well, why would ChatGPT? From a naive point of view, you wouldn't go to ChatGPT and expect it to just make up cases.
And yet it seems to be happening all the time. They call it hallucinating, which I hate because that just that anthropomorphizes the AI.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't like I don't like hallucination.
It's just fabrication. It's just lying and invention and fabrication. But under the guise of authority.
And it tends to downplay the fact that when it's accurate, it's not accurate with any sort of ChatGPT doesn't have grounding. It's accurate by probability, not because ChatGPT has actually done research and says, yes, this is what corresponds to reality. It's just that the text it was generating went down the right pathways instead of the wrong pathways.
So as more and more ChatGPT type text is loaded onto the internet, and it seems to be happening at a tremendous rate already. There's entire news sites that are completely 100% generated by ChatGPT. As the internet has more and more, how can the content not just get worse and worse, kind of like a cassette that you make an endless number of copies of?
Yeah, well, once you get into AI generated text, it becomes a trickier matter. I would, to go back to an earlier point, by flooding the zone with garbage, you will actually delegitimize the stuff that seems more convincing to begin with. So it may perversely actually have a positive effect by causing people to give up on the accuracy of anything they read online.
We're getting a little short on time. I wanted to get into some of the other topics that you talk about in your book, Meganets. If you're just joining us, we're talking to David Auerbach, author of the recent book, Meganets, How Digital Forces Beyond Our Control Commandeer Our Daily Lives and Inner Realities. And David, you also get into the book about how governments, how various national governments are getting in on the act. And that's also happening at a very rapid rate these days. And you talk a lot about India's Aadhaar system. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. So Aadhaar, I think, is an augur of the future. Aadhaar is India's national identity system. Every citizen is issued a single number that acts as their identifier for across all government services and for an increasing number of non-government services, like getting a bank account or a cell phone. You know, we don't have that here. We don't have it here yet anyway. We have a different, our driver's license number is not our social security number, is not our Medicare number, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, for efficiency's sake, there's a great appeal there. But what I get into in the book is that over the course of creating these systems, you do draw them together in the form of what I call a meganet, that the more you tie people to a single identifier, the more systems based on that identifier will combine, coalesce, and create the sort of feedback effects at a greater level than we see now. And other countries are already looking into Aadhaar-like systems. And within India, you're already seeing that, you know, identity theft on a scale that you could never imagine before has happened. And that if one aspect of it is compromised, it's no longer localized and contained. It can spread to everything because that single number is you everywhere.
And you talked about how Aadhaar, India's national identity system, started off as optional. And of course, it was going to accomplish all these wonderful things. And how has it evolved?
Yeah, it's funny because it was always said that it would only be voluntary. And there was even lawsuits to force alternatives. And yet, even if it is technically optional, the amount of hoops you have to go through to avoid having and using an Aadhaar number pretty much make it prohibitive. And this is another effect of what I call meganets, which is that they grow and they spread. And even though the intention was for, I genuinely believe that the intention was for it not to be required. And yet, even the entire government of India could not prevent it from being all but mandatory.
And is it a problem endemic to the other meganets where nobody truly understands exactly what's going on inside the box?
Yes, with Aadhaar, there's a bit less of the algorithmic problem so far because they aren't, Aadhaar's applications aren't quite as, say, AI or algorithmically driven. It's more pure data, but there's no reason why that would have to be the case. You know, you're seeing cases in which algorithms are being used to predict recidivism and things like that. More complicated algorithms are going to make their way into government applications. So at that point, yeah, the Pandora's box is open and you're going to see whatever has been happening on meganets here start to happen on government-based meganets, et cetera, et cetera.
And can you contrast India's Aadhaar system with China's social credit system?
Yeah, the social credit system is a very interesting case. So there's been a lot of, I think, scary stuff written about the social credit system, which is the idea, the conception that, oh, China rates its citizens on how good they are. So that, oh, if you buy too much alcohol, China downgrades you and thinks you're a worse human being. And the interesting thing is that while it certainly is not what you would think of as any sort of ideal of civil liberties, the myth seems to far outstrip the reality, which is that it seems to mostly be used to contain and persecute those who actually do have convictions against them, or at least so that, in other words, a subset of the population. And that's not good, but it's very different than the sort of big brother-like surveillance that it's being perceived as. So the question is, isn't there an irony here that Aadhaar really is pervasive, but China's social credit system isn't? When it comes to oppression, China tends to rely on some more old-fashioned methods. They aren't tracking people digitally because I believe what China has found is that it is difficult to control those systems. That when during COVID, there were people who got quarantined based on bad information, sometimes based on bad actors in the government. And it was not easy to make to figure this out. And because you have this party-run state, blame immediately accrues to the party. Whereas in India, many of Aadhaar's infelicities and disasters are fobbed off on the private sector, which uses the Aadhaar number. In other words, they're part of this network, but they also serve as a scapegoat so that they say, well, all the government does is give the number, so we can't possibly be responsible if the data around this number that's provided by private industries happens to get coalesced and used against you. So the irony there is that because they have more total responsibility, China seems to have actually been more cautious about deploying a government-driven MegaNet to that autonomous degree. And that's not to defend China, and it's not to condemn India. It's more to observe that both of them reveal cases in which you have to deal with the fact that the system is not as controllable as it was anticipated to be, even as it becomes more ubiquitous.
And do you know anything about what's going on in other countries? Because I keep hearing that lots of other countries are implementing various things. But do you happen to know, is it more along the line of India's model or China's model or something different?
It's more India's model that to the extent that these sorts of developments are occurring, they tend to be occurring in more liberalized economies. I wouldn't be surprised if less liberalized countries start deploying them as well, but they tend to be a bit further behind the times. So I think you're going to see India's model become popular. I think you're going to see it start to get implemented in the United States as well, simply because there's going to be a lot of pressure to as online governmental systems multiply. It's going to seem very logical and obvious that people should have shared identifiers rather than creating new accounts on for every single government service. It's just that brings up the MegaNet problems that we've been discussing.
Do you know anything about how Estonia is handling? Does Estonia have a single individual ID?
I'm pretty sure that they do. Estonia is small. Which certainly helps on their own. And even they, I think, they like to think of themselves as sort of a test lab for these technologies. But they're small enough, and especially the sort of the network part, the hyper networked, whatever part of Estonia is small enough, is that effectively you're looking at something that it's hard to gauge what happens when you scale up. Because, I mean, that in a way, that's the point that I'm making, is that so much of this only happened past a certain scale of size. And since Estonia is constrained by you know, its borders and sheerly small population, Estonia is able to get away with it in a way that India, which of course has a humongous population, cannot.
Right.
So, and it may be counterintuitive to say, like, well, why? If it works for Estonia, why don't you just scale it up? But that's exactly it, is that it's not a linear scaling. As you connect more and more people, you have more and more connections between people and between systems, so it becomes exponential. And so things get out of control at a faster than linear rate, and that's exactly the source of our problem.
Mm-hmm. In your book, MegaNets, you also talk about a bit about the history of the human desire to see non-human intelligence, and you talk about Clever Hans, the horse. The horse.
Yeah.
Talk a bit about Clever Hans and how you think it relates to the age we're living in now.
Yeah, so Clever Hans was this horse in the early part of the 20th century that its trainer, its teacher, said could do math and answer all sorts of other questions as well. And you know, he would ask it mathematic problems and it would clop out the right answer. And what a very clever psychologist discovered was that the horse would only get the right answer if it could see the experimenter. As it turned out, the horse was not actually solving the problem. What it was doing was detecting subconscious cues in the teacher as to when it should stop clopping its foot. And humans, in turn, were anthropomorphizing its thinking that, well, because it's getting the right answer, it must be doing something human-like. And I think that's happening with ChatGPT to a large extent, albeit at a much higher level, because once it's using words, it's that much more convincing. I mean, it is pretty. I will not deny that what ChatGPT does is amazing in its ability to generate human-seeming text. That just poses that much more of a danger of us reading into it intention, thought, cognition, you name it, that isn't actually there. And that's why it's a trick in the way that Clever Hans is. We trick ourselves.
Okay, great. David, thanks so much for talking to us today. We've been talking with David Auerbach, author of the recent book, MegaNets, How Digital Forces Beyond Our Control Commandeer Our Daily Lives and Inner Realities. And David, how can people follow your work? I know that you're on Substack, and where else?
Yeah, Substack is probably the best. I'm OurStack, AuerStack. You can look at my site, which is David Auerbach, except with a dot between before the CH, because it's the Swiss domain. That apparently confuses people. I'm on Twitter at AuerbachKeller, K-E-L-L-E-R. That's a Goethe reference, which probably has never done me any favors either. So OurStack is probably the best bet. And my book is available in all the usual places, MegaNets and my earlier book, Bitwise. Thanks for having me on WFMU, the best damn radio station in the country.
Thank you, David. That was David Auerbach talking about his recent book, MegaNets. And it turns out David is a huge fan of WFMU and, in particular, progressive music. Very appropriate since Dave Mandel's prog rock show, It's Complicated, is coming up in 15 minutes. And that does give us about 15 minutes to take your phone calls at 201-209-9368 if you have any thoughts or comments or questions about the things that David was talking about. And his Substack is quite excellent, and his book is quite excellent, and it's written in a very non-technical way. It's definitely written for lay people. His last post on Substack dealt more in detail with this absurd notion that ChatGPT and other AI language models are hallucinating, and he talks about why. The mere idea of characterizing these fabrications that ChatGPT has been engaging in as hallucinations, even that, calling it a hallucination, implies something that is not true. Because to hallucinate, it suggests that there's a set of things that are known to be part of reality, and there's another set of things that are known to not be part of reality. And of course, large language models have no notion whatsoever of that. And as I've said before on this program, when I've filled in for Mark Hurst, this is station manager Ken filling in tonight, humanity has a long and fascinating history of trying to ascribe human qualities to non-human entities, whether they're robots or pieces of clay or horses or now software programs. He talked about Clever Hans, the horse in 1904, which faked out the public by the trainer pretending that it could do mathematical problems. An even earlier example was the German Mechanical Turk, not the Amazon site Mechanical Turk, but the original Mechanical Turk, which was a chess-playing robot which could beat anybody at chess. The only problem was that there was an excellent chess player hanging out inside the Mechanical Turk. So this kind of thing goes on, and our most recent object of anthropomorphic wish fulfillment is ChatGPT and large language models as we try to imagine, or as many people have been imagining, that they've become sentient, that they're conscious, that they understand the difference between the truth and lies and fabrications, which, of course, they don't. And the point that I was trying to make a couple of times during the interview with David is that as the internet gets more and more misinformation and disinformation on it, and programs like ChatGPT use the internet to create their language model, how can that problem do anything other than just get worse and worse? But we shall see. The phone lines are open. Phone number here, if you have any thoughts about David's talk, about the interview tonight, is 201-209-9368. Hi, you're on the air. Thanks for calling Tectonic.
Hi, yeah. This whole thing makes you aware of how many people out there have never had an original thought in their life. They think in terms of cliches, and they don't even know what sincerity is. I call it like if they got if someone close to them died and they got a card, a Hallmark card, they can't tell the difference between that and if the friend had sat down and written a letter from the heart. They don't know. There's a lot of people out there, they function in a cliche world. And that's why they can be fooled so easily by this ChatGPT. They can't tell the original from real life.
No, it's true. It's true. It's not like we're just starting down this road of reductionism and
right. Absolutely.
Yeah. No, we've been heading down it for a very, very long time. And Hallmark cards are a great example.
Yeah.
Of
don't
that.
You, don't yeah. you see? Like you like earlier. I hallucinated because I thought you said hallucinate, like, and then I thought you said collucinate. I said, well, there I want to coin that phrase. We're hallucinating together. We're collucinating.
Collucinating.
Collaborating.
Yeah, collaborative hallucination. That's a great.
Or colluding is in there too, but you know, you have to have a kind of open, creative mind in this world. A lot of people, they wouldn't notice it. It's not like, oh, there's a good idea. It's not that. I mean, you walk around the world. It's as if we live among zombies.
I hear you,
but it does
make those of us who are not zombies, and those of us who are not hypnotized, stand out a little bit. That's the one silver lining I can find in all of this. I'm going to be filling in for Tectonic again. I think on July 17th, and I wanted to talk that night more about AI music and AI radio, but also,
oh, yeah.
and just as with all things AI, I mean, AI music and AI radio have been, or automated radio and automated music have been around for a really, really long time. It's not like it's a brand new concept. And
right, it's like if they said, no, I mean it from the bottom of my microprocessor instead of heart. It's like, that might be fine to people if you're listening to an automated DJ. I mean it from the bottom of my microprocessor. Oh, that's sincerity.
Well, thanks for your call. I love your term. What is it? hallucinations. Yeah, mass hallucinations, collaborative hallucinations, hallucinations. Thanks for your call. The phone number here, we have another 8 minutes before It's Complicated with Dave Mandel comes up. And the phone number is 201-209-9368. Along with the problem of AI and the internet getting filled up with misinformation, including what are erroneously called ChatGPT hallucinations, I tried to make an analogy during the interview that didn't quite come off right, which is that my feeling is that as there's more and more misinformation and utter fabrication on the internet, and it certainly seems like there's more and more of it all the time. The internet started off seeming fairly accurate. It started off really just coming from universities, and it seemed like most things on the internet back in the very, very early days were scientifically backed up or factually based, and that is certainly not the case anymore. And since the way these AI models work is to just eat itself, is to eat the internet in terms of images or film or text, it seems, and that becomes the fertilizer for the next generation of ChatGPT and other fabrications. I just don't see how it can do anything except continue to get worse and worse. And the analogy I tried to use was making an endless copy of a cassette, when what I really meant was making endless generational copies of cassettes, to copy one cassette to the next and then take the second copy and make a third copy from that and then make a fourth copy from the third copy, kind of like Alvin Lucier's famous audio piece, I Am Sitting in a Room, if you know what I'm talking about. I'm not going to go into an explanation on that. David Auerbach also talked a lot in that interview about tainting the data bank. And I wanted to talk about that if anybody feels like calling it, 201-209-9368. Have you ever intentionally put up false information about yourself on a social network, such as David mentioned that he intentionally uses a wrong birth date on Facebook on the assumption that maybe Facebook uses somebody's birth date to match up all the identity data that it has on him with the data that it gets from other sources. So by using an erroneous birth date on Facebook, he can prevent the dossier. He's hoping that the dossier can perhaps be prevented from growing even larger. We have a call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Ken. Thanks for hosting again, taking calls.
Hey, who's this?
It's Zachary.
Oh, hey, Zach.
Hey, kind of this conversation about it eating itself too, it reminded me when I was working in the ed biz, there was a lot of cheating algorithms that would read papers and, you know, try to say, oh, this was plagiarized to a certain percentage.
Right.
It's kind of like your point about feeding itself. We're going to reach the point, is there, or the original thoughts, kind of like the other caller was having in regards to that. Because how many ways can you really say certain things that are simplistic at different levels? And so, you know, these models being fed, I don't know, reductionist type material, it's just going to bottom out, and then eventually we'll have to create some kind of alternative, you know, not a dark net, but the correct net.
I hear you. I think I know what you mean. I mean, another way that I kind of think about it is that I'm a news junkie. And since the beginning of the internet, the quality of news has just gotten worse and worse and worse. And I'm not even talking about whether it's true or not. I'm just talking about, like, the length of the article, you know, how jam-packed it is with ads and videos and whether it even works. Just the quality of news, it's just, of digital news, just is amazingly terrible and continues to get worse and worse.
Well, I think, too, a lot of the link rot component, you know, where I live, we've had several of the local media agencies, TV, newspaper, otherwise, reboot their websites, and then they atrophy off all the previous articles, so there's no history.
Right, yeah.
You know, so the local TV station, you can't even go back, you know, a few years ago and find their old articles and videos because they nuked the website and it's all gone. Same thing with the newspaper or even the college newspaper that's around here. It's real hard to find anything beyond 5 years.
Yep.
And so there's no historical record. It's all, like your point, you know, it's all just the current.
Thank God for the Wayback Machine, although the Internet Archive's having some major legal copyright problems now. But hey,
yeah, about the book.
Yeah,
right?
Zachary,
loaning out the books during the pandemic and whatnot.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you something you brought up, which is these software detection systems for detecting plagiarized term papers. I've heard that there are there's programs that will detect whether something was generated by ChatGPT. Have you ever heard, or programs like ChatGPT, have you heard anything about those?
Yeah, no, I've read some articles. I tried one. It worked all right. Again, I think it comes down to what topic you're going about, and then what, you know, how simplistic can it be discussed? Is it real niche? Then obviously it's a little easier to detect if it's ripping off another paper. But, you know, if you're just talking about, you know, even a band, you know, how many ways can you write the bio of, you know, name some band or something, or even the biography of WFMU. You know, how many different ways can you really write the general information?
Yeah,
that's unique. It's, you know, it's a lot of facts.
I'm sure
that's a lot of names.
That's going to be an ultimate cat and mouse game of
detection
systems versus the BS machine, as maybe it'll come to be known. Well, Zachary, thanks a lot for your call. We are out of time here on Tectonic. And I'll be filling in for Mark Hurst again on July 17th, talking about radio and music automation. And I'm not sure what Mark's got planned, but he's definitely coming back next week. This is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Thanks for hanging out, everybody. And stay tuned for It's Complicated with Dave Mantle.
That marks the beginning of another episode of It's Complicated. Welcome, I'm Dave Mandel, your host. I'm here every Monday between the hours of 7 and 8 with this program. 60 minutes of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. Thanks for joining me. I should mention before I go any further that today the new summer schedule here at FMU went into effect, and few or no changes on Monday. Actually, I'm happy to say I'm still here. I'm going to be on the summer schedule due to some administrative error. No, but seriously, I'm here probably because of you, because of the response to this show, which has been really positive and really appreciated. And I really thank everybody who has been supportive of this show in its short lifetime. I've been here for maybe 6 months or so doing this show, and it's been great, and I've been thrilled, and thanks everybody who has supported the show so far. I'm here at least until the end of the summer, and then we'll see. I have a few, astronaut-related things, let's say, to start the show today. First of all, So in the early 70s, some of you may know, there was a huge best-selling book called Chariots of the Gods. And this book advanced the theory that astronauts from some other planet had visited Earth many, many years ago and taught the, you know, very primitive human beings here at the time how to make tools and make things. Astronauts had come here and helped sort of kickstart human civilization on Earth. And this was a tremendously popular book. It was a huge bestseller, tremendous bestseller. And it was a really attractive theory. I was a little kid at the time, and I remember it, and I was fascinated by it. I mean, astronauts, there were all these, they dug up all these ancient cave carvings with figures that clearly were astronauts, you know, cave people making drawings of the astronauts who'd come to visit them and so on. Amazing. It turned out, of course, not of course, but it turned out to be a scam. Not only was it not true, disappointingly, but I believe that a lot of the evidence, there were a lot of the many photos in the book of these ancient carvings and so on, a lot of them were fakes, were forgeries. And this was terrible, terribly sad news. But the book was a tremendous bestseller, and naturally there were a couple of sequels, spin-off books of it. Eric von Daniken was the author. So why do I mention this? I'm going to play a couple things to open this week's show related to that book. One of them, I'm going to start with something from the Peter Thomas Sound Orchestra, German composer, and this is going to be a track, going to be a very short piece, a track from the film of Chariots of the Gods. Did I mention the name of the book? I may not have. Chariots of the Gods, with a question mark at the end. Chariots of the Gods was the title of the book. So naturally, there was a film made of the book, Chariots of the Gods, and we're going to hear a track from that soundtrack. And it's not a particularly proggy soundtrack, but this piece is, actually. I feel comfortable playing this piece on the show. A lot of harpsichord. If you can't get your hands on a mellotron, a harpsichord is second best. So there's some harpsichord, and it's a pretty proggy piece. And as I said, it's short. Following this piece by the Peter Thomas Sound Orchestra, we're going to hear something really special, something that is pretty rare and not heard very often. There was a group called Absolute Elsewhere, and it was just a one-off project, as far as I know, in 1976. This group did one album, and the most notable thing for Prague fans was that Bill Bruford, you know, one of the greatest of the Prague musicians, drummer in King Crimson, Bill Bruford played on the album. And after, well, this is probably getting too far down the rabbit hole here, but after King Crimson broke up, the fantastic mid-70s lineup of King Crimson broke up, Bill Bruford was kind of directionless, I think, and just played with a bunch of different weird assortment of groups. And he found his way just maybe to make money, I don't know, as a session he played on this album. So we're going to hear a track from an album after the Peter Thomas piece. We're going to hear a track from that album. The group is Absolute Elsewhere, and the album title is, I've forgotten the album title, In Search of Ancient Gods, I think is the title. And yes, directly, in fact, on the cover of the album it says, you know, based on the book by Eric von Daniken. Okay, so Peter Thomas Orchestra from the Chariots of the Gods soundtrack, followed by Absolute Elsewhere featuring Bill Bruford. A pretty cool piece, the Bill Bruford one, as you'll hear. Here we go.